welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I am joined by David Drake, who is the founder and CEO of the Moment Institute. He's also created Narrative Coaching, is a pioneer in that field. We're going to be exploring today this topic of beyond coaching. It's a theme that's come up for me and for others recently more and more often. And we've been looking at it in many different ways, just on the level where a lot of coaching friends I met said the word felt too small. Feels like the word has also diluted its meaning. Can now mean mentor, productivity hacker, self-helper, telling people how to do something, you know, AI bots. It's a diluted word. But also it's been born out of a certain paradigm of what it means to be human. And so we're going to be exploring in some podcasts what might lie beyond coaching. And today we'll do that with David. He'll share about his meeting with Timothy Galway and John Whitmore and their view on the use of the word coach, which was surprising. We'll talk about some of the ways that David feels that the industry needs to mature and the traps that we can fall into when we identify with that word coach and how we can move beyond it. And we'll talk about maturity, and David will share what is the primary way that we can mature ourselves and the impact that will have on us as coaches. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Let's dive in. Here's David Drake. Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey, so I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake, and if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. David, so it's good to be with you again, and we're going to talk about this topic of coaching beyond coaching today, and we'll talk about, I think that will reference us back to your paper that's come out in its kind of most recent or finalized form, The Five Maturities, a New Paradigm for Coach Development. I'm sure we'll go back to that, and so let's get right in there.
Sure.
Could you share a little bit of the story you told me about, you know, the coaches coming to join your session? What's been unfolding for you recently? Yeah.
So now that I've finished the paper, I've started to do a few presentations. So I spent some time at the Institute of Coaching Conference on healthcare and leadership. And then now we've done an event for our own community, and just the reception's been pretty extraordinary, and kind of the theme that we're hearing from people. So I was really curious, like, what brought them to this sort of new and emerging idea? And it was the notion of freedom. And I'm sort of observing in this world, as people get increasingly maybe anxious or afraid of the future, that they're kind of going on two directions. One are trying to close down, and they want everybody to be the same, and because that makes them feel more, you know, sort of settled, I suppose. And then many others are going the opposite direction. They want to be their fullest, freest self, to express the best of who they are. And so in coaching, what people are appreciating is that they feel like historically, a lot of their lived or studied experience was not taken seriously in coaching. Or it was always you had all that, and now you have to be a coach. And yes, you might use your expertise to coach around a certain thing like sales or something, but kind of the idiosyncrasies that make you a human being, we're sort of like trying to, this is how we do things. This is how you ask a question. This is how you have to look when you're listening. And people are saying, but yeah, that's not me. And what they're appreciating is somebody just sort of speaking some things that they have long felt, but never had the courage to say out loud. And this feeling like they're coming home to just themselves and to be others who are themselves and finding something that might be new in the coaching space.
I'm curious, what is it that you're saying, those things that have never been spoken that are, you think, inviting them back?
Well, I think so. What the obvious sort of foil in this are competency models, and they have, so there's a lot of what we do in coaching that's based on them that doesn't really have any grounding in research at all. And competency models are great for beginners. I'm a chef for the first time or a school teacher for the first time. And if I'm your boss, I want to know, does the teacher know how to create a lesson plan? Do they need to know how to deal with differences in kids? Do they know their material? So there's some basics for any profession. But and so they, that's sort of guardrails. It's a way to kind of help people get the basics down. But beyond that, it doesn't have a lot of value in so much. And it sort of ends up being a bit of a lazy way of trying to manage people or assess people. And so, like for me, I people that have advanced in their coaching practice and in their life tend to kind of know the depth of the intent of those competencies, but can transcend them because it's now just in our DNA and we can mix and match lots of things. And so when I used to demo narrative coaching, people would say, well, yeah, but you didn't set an agenda. Well, the client didn't want an agenda. That's your need as a coach for an agenda. If somebody needs help focusing, like they come in all like just, then bringing them to center and themselves would be a useful first step. But I said the vast majority of conversations in real life emerge spontaneously or in a surprising way. We don't plan them. And most of our clients have no idea why they're really there until we start talking. Oh, that's why I'm here. And so we want to be able to move away from trying to get people to contort themselves to a model as opposed to their true authentic self. And even more importantly, what's actually happening in real time with the human being sitting across from them. And so we're trying to explore the possibilities of what else could we do to help a coach get a sense of where they are in their developmental journey and what might be helpful. And one of the things I realized pretty quickly is the biggest difference between a great coach and a good coach is not more competency, it's the depth of their maturity. And so I just have a big piece now in the paper around how do we start advocating for maturity as a category, and then use that as sort of the basis to imagine different ways of developing coaches.
So there's a few things in there I want to have written down that I'll come back to. How can we cultivate maturity being one of those? But in a sense, like this might be one way we could look at beyond coaching is, if coaching is defined as a set of competencies, which are, like you named, they're good for beginners, but actually quite limiting, simplified, maybe even fixed notions of what coaching is. That So in a sense, like what I'm hearing you say is that masterful coaches grow beyond that system of what can be defined as being a coach and begin to access their authentic self. They begin to access a kind of freedom that allows for a different quality of conversation to take place. Do you feel still that the word coach is the right word for you? Do you feel that it's become too small of a role? Is like, are we in a way when we're talking about masterful coaching, are we still talking about coaching? Are we talking about something else?
Well, it's funny. And truth be told, when I started narrative coaching 25 years ago, I chose coaching because it was the closest I could find to some way I could make money doing what I was already doing and what I loved and what I thought I was at my best. I've been very grateful for my journey through coaching, because it provided a nice laboratory for me to write and think and meet people like you and have a place for myself. But I've never really identified as I'm a coach. I've never said that about myself, even when I in periods when I would do a lot of coaching, because I knew that I was bringing so much else to the table, and coach was a label I could get paid for, and a client recognized, oh, that's coaching. I know that. Ooh, I like the way he coaches. I would like some more of that. But I went in the course of writing the report, I came across a paper I wrote years ago, based on an interview with John Whitmore and Tim Galway. And they had once been quite close and they had kind of a falling out. And so my interview actually brought them back together again, which was quite lovely for the field. But they both lamented that the word coaching was chosen in the beginning. They said it's not the right word. John was bringing this in from sports and motor racing, and Tim was bringing this in from his deep spiritual quest. And but they both said we should have thought of a better word. And I've spent a year trying to think of a better word, and I've not really come up with anything yet. And I've sort of let go of that need now. But I think what's going to happen, my basic sort of hypothesis in the paper is that coaching doesn't know what it wants to be when it grows up. It's gotten way big really fast. And people have all kinds of things at stake now. And so for me, I looked at coaching will become an ecosystem in which traditional coaches will be part of the ecosystem. But I also think like people like myself that have a very integrative practice, we also need ongoing support and would like some ways to check in on ourselves about how we're doing and are we doing a good job. But we don't have that because we don't. I would never pass an ICF exam because I would have no interest in any things they're measuring me on, and I would feel absurd. But for some people, that's lovely. They like that structure. They like that simplicity. Oh, I just do these things. And for a newer coach or people that work maybe in more traditional environments, or so I'm not saying we should get rid of that. I'm just saying that's just a small sliver of what coaching now encompasses, but not very consciously. And so I look at it now, I just keep reminding people coaching is a verb. It's not a noun. We made it, reified it into a noun, and then we all assumed we thought it meant this one thing. And I didn't, yeah.
I think that that's actually one of the major fallacies of our times across the board. We made things into nouns, in a big way, and it came out of the modernity, and there's value in it to an extent, but then everything, became kind of congealed and reified and disconnected us from our living experience, and which is, again, in your paper, actually one of the calls I hear you making. Is like coaching as a deep immersion in the authentic connection of being with someone. I'm just going to highlight on things you share because they're just when you met Timothy Galway and John Whitmore, and they said this is fascinating to me because they're all real kind of in the lineage of coaching. Some of the founders or at least earlier on. So, did they say what word they would prefer to have used?
What did come out of, again, this is all a surprise. I mean, this is like one of my most thrilling moments ever as an academic or whatever in the coaching space to talk to these guys. And they both realized for the first time that their invitation to coaching or even to that space before it was really coaching, both came from Esalen in California at different at a similar period, but at different times. And Tim was there primarily for spiritual development. This was, John reported that this was way outside of his comfort zone, but he was out there doing something else and decided to pop in. And he said, it just changed my whole life. He's this, you know, British guy and doing all these things. And they just saw coaching as a way to make sort of enlightening therapeutic kind of practices available to the average person, kind of bringing that in a way to accelerate growth in people at work. But I don't think either of them were comfortable. Tim, I mean, John's is mostly because he said, we just sort of, because coaching grew so fast, it just vacuumed up things from other fields. So for example, in my talk yesterday, I was with some folks, I was saying, yeah, we just inhaled the therapeutic hour. And so we started billing by the hour. No one asked why we did that, or no one did any research if that's what we should do, but that's what therapists did. We wanted to show that we too, you know, so we felt like we're sort of like younger brothers trying to prove ourselves to the older brother called psychotherapy. And Tim said, I mean, and John said, we brought all these things in from sports, which again, wasn't necessarily bad because there's some things from sports coaching, which are really powerful methodologies, but we didn't necessarily invent organic resources and frames for this new and emerging field. And we never went back to question them. And I feel like a lot of what we're operating under now are just outdated. They don't reflect the world we live in now, and they don't speak to what people are really looking for.
You even there was a line, and I didn't copy it out, but it was like I want to refer to something you wrote in your paper from here, but it was like something along the lines of, look, if we're honest in our heart of hearts, you know, we can admit that some of the things in what we do in terms of the ecosystem just aren't as effective as they could be, or don't work as well. And I think that's one thing that's always bugged me, is that like meeting my client once every 2 weeks for an hour kind of thing feels wholly insufficient. Although, you know, you talk about the therapeutic hour. I actually often find like I prefer having 90 minutes, you know, so like you could go shorter, which there's value in that, you know, absolutely. But so actually what you're saying now about the things we've inherited kind of takes me back to what you talked about with the ecosystem. This is where I want to refer to your paper as well, where you talk about phases in a coaching cycle, you know, how, you know, we often value that coaching hour the most. We think, you know, you've got a little table where it's like the investment is high in that, but the benefit on that is actually medium. And what you're pointing to is how post-session, that we can leverage the coaching and our investment in that is low, but the benefit is high. And I think it makes me want to, I've got a reflection on that, but first I want to ask you about, what is your view on the kinds of innovation needed in the ecosystem? And AI is coming in, and you know, it's obvious it's all going to get disrupted, isn't it? So
it already is disrupted. Yes,
yeah.
We just don't realize it yet. I didn't coin this phrase, but I like to think of myself as, on good days, as an enlightened pragmatist. I do things that I try to bring as much consciousness and thought to it, but in reality, I do what I do because I feel it works. And if it doesn't work, I try to make it better. And so for me, the value, both enlightenment and pragmatism, come into a critique of how we think about coaching. So when we're, there's two pieces of that. One is that, ironically, a lot of the breakthroughs for our students in our programs come when they stop coaching and actually start paying attention. What's actually happening in your own experience right now? What's actually happening in front of you? What is the story actually saying? And when you're trying so earnestly to coach, you miss most of that. And then secondly, with that, we're trying to find a way to get people to be able to notice our fundamental narrative coaching question, which is, what does this human being need most right now? And change is such a mystery. It doesn't follow our models. It's not convenient, but it's very rare that somebody can move through an entire development cycle in an hour. And so people get enamored with aha moments. Aha moments mean nothing, absolutely nothing.
Is that true though? Like ab absolutely nothing? I mean, I get why you're saying it, but
I know.
does it
I'm
mean
being a bit.
absolutely nothing? I don't think I agree with that.
I didn't finish the sentence, but I was being a
Sorry,
bit.
sorry, sorry. Okay.
Just want to see if you heard it. With. No, they can mean a lot, but they're often. I look at they're like, oh, we're planting a different kind of seed now, but it's going to take a while to germinate and for them to reflect on it and do some things. And so again, there's a lot of pressure that coaches feel. I need to get to an outcome by the end of the session. And that's like, I mean, it's useful because it just keeps us focused. But in reality, what we've started might take days, weeks, months, sometimes even years for the client to realize what just happened. And so clients don't grow in linear sequences like sessions, right? So the sessions take place in a much larger journey the person's been on and may have been on their entire life. And so I'm always thinking of ourselves as coaches, as we just walk alongside our clients as they're finding their way at this part of their journey and trying to discern what would be useful to them. And so a big piece of that is that my firm belief that the client and things related to the client is the most significant variable in coaching. And so if we're going to treat a client then that way, and the client being a beautiful, flawed, wonderful creature like all of us, then that journey is going to be like this. And we're just like taking little snapshots of like, here's where I'm seeing you now. Hey, let's go try that. What are you noticing? But if you've lived long enough, you might have had say a childhood experience that you reflect on 30 times, 50 times. And every time you reflect on it, you see something you didn't see before. And because you get more mature, you get wiser, you have more lived experience, you have more knowledge. And so the aha moments can be important, but not for reasons that we think. And a lot of it's just the beginning of a journey. It's like a door is open to a new room. But the real journey is the client ready, willing, and able to walk in and do something? Either shift themselves, shift their behavior, shift their perspective, grow their compassion, whatever it is they're after. But that's actually quite an immersive and unfolding process. And they're going to discover different things as that process kind of moves through. And so if you So, which means then I find value in holding space for that to go where it needs to go in terms of what the person's able to do at that time, knowing full well that we're probably going to visit this topic again as new awareness comes available, as they go and do new things, which then generates new insights. So I look at the aha moment as perhaps the beginning of a journey, not oh, we've arrived. That's a eureka moment. And it only means something if the client decides to act on it.
So I think again, just like there's a lot in what you're saying here, and I think a lot of it points to this frame of beyond coaching for me. If we conceive of coaching as something more structural, often based in a sense of we need to get an outcome, we're heading towards a predetermined outcome. As opposed to what I'm hearing you saying, which is, this is a more organic process or biological process, not mechanistic process, and that the coaching goes where it needs to go. And that's so for me, like that's been one of the things I've been questioning about beyond coaching is like a lot of people not my clients, because they know what I'm about, but when I did more corporate coaching, people would just be like, okay, almost like you're gonna give me something by the end of the session, you know? And it's like it needs to be useful. Now I get, of course, we don't want coaching. We get into this paradox, don't we? Because we do, of course, it wants to have an outcome of people need. But yeah, I think you get my point. So I'm hearing this kind of gestalt, you know, even you said like when coaches stop coaching, and actually like they're here with what's happening now, that's when there can be a breakthrough. And I think that also points to that we have some strange idea, or strange might not be the right way, but when we actually let go of trying, you know, trying to coach, and we're able to be spacious enough to be with and we relax into ourselves and what's here right now, that's when we tap into this more organic, innate intelligence of the development process. So, yeah.
I was thinking, because somebody asked me a couple of days ago when I was doing a talk on all this about, well, what are some other parallels or analogies for coaching if it's not therapy? And I said, well, there was a guy named Vin Marty who developed this thing called Five Rhythms, which is a dance kind of process. I don't know if you're familiar with it at all, but I love it, and it's a great training ground for coaches, because music comes on and you have to find out what does your being want to do in response to that particular rhythm. But then you do that for like 10, 15 minutes or whatever, and then the rhythm changes. So like now I've got to like find another part of myself. And so in many ways, I often see coaches as choreographers in real time, that we're moving ourselves physically, emotionally, spiritually, cognitively, to match or, you know, kind of accompany the client in whatever they're doing. And sometimes we can lead, like, hey, let's go look over here. But sometimes we surrender and they lead, and we can see if they how they do that. But we're never doing the same thing for an hour. And so we're always trying to understand, you know, what is this story wanting from us? What is this moment asking of us? Where do we feel drawn to go spend time and energy? And what I find is that, yes, you can bring the need for progress or outcome into the conversation, because you don't want to be just like wandering around like whirling dervishes for days. I mean, some people do that, but most of us want to feel like I'm doing this rhythm because I'm accessing grief I wasn't aware of in myself. Or I've been really pent up all week at my desk. I want to be just free and have can be completely you know, out of control in a way. And so again, it goes back to that's not about learning about parts of the brain or all of which is great. It's more about our own maturity. Could I surrender my need to manage the coaching conversation to allow the conversation to drive what we need to be doing here? And can I follow or lead in that space as I need to get the best possible experience for the client?
How important do you think that is as a capacity for coaches?
I think it's huge. I think it's everything. I mean, because and the beauty of that is that we're each going to have our own backgrounds and our own preferences and knowledge sets that we're going to bring to that. And so we have a lot of, you know, a lot of people come to your programs, have spent a lot of time investing in like the neurobiology of being human and the use of our somatic awareness and stuff. So you'll be able, those people will be able to bring much more somatic offers to the table, or resources to the table, framings and understandings, where the people might have more, you know, psychological background. So they're going to bring that. But it's just then knowing what you're bringing, but it's all the same motion, which is just, again, responding in real time to the conversation, to the story, to the human, to the unfolding, and what do we need to be here? And so the danger of any label then, like coach, is then people think I have to be here to be the coach. And then they get locked into what they think that means. And then again, I find, and all that's wonderful at one level, but it then doesn't allow. I remember once I was doing a demo and I said something quite compassionate but stark to a client, to the person pretending to be the client. And the class was aghast. You can't say that. And I said, Who's sad? So I turned to the so in their debrief, I turned to the person that volunteered, and they said, "Well, it wasn't what I was expecting because I think of coaches as this." But when I sat back, I had to admit he's right, and it's actually exactly what I needed to hear. And so, coaching is just a label or a frame within which we can have some agreements with people to work with them. But I feel like sometimes, again, people get locked into I'm the coach. And then all kinds of other stuff come with that, which often keep them from being their highest and best self.
So in a sense, like beyond coaching as a system, as an identity that one identifies with, and which affords a certain way of seeing and being with somebody, but also closes down other possibilities. And so I'm hearing a kind of almost like post-systemic move where, one can like pick up different roles as needed, and well, person as choreographer, so that's another kind of archetype almost.
Well, and I wanted to be really clear too. I'm not saying get rid of coaching. It's not like leaving coaching. It's just operating outside of coaching in the sense of coaching provides a lot of great resources, some decent research. It provides frames and tools that are quite good in some cases. But it just means that I don't conflate my own identity with that of coaching or being a coach. I don't, and so I don't want to appear significantly different in a coaching session than I would be if I was at your house having dinner. Yeah, one will be more formal and one has a set of expectations, dinner does not. But I want to be my full best self 24 hours a day. And there's opportunities and requirements in coaching because the person's paying you money to achieve something. But I watch people struggle because they sometimes believe, now I have to be a coach to go do this. I've got to kind of be somebody. I said, no, you're supposed if what I've found over time is the more you let go of trying to conform to what you think coaching is going to be, the better coach you become because you actually become more yourself.
What do you think is the biggest barrier? And we've been naming them already, but the biggest barrier to people making that transition beyond coaching into being themselves.
Well, again, part of it's the ambiguity in coaching. So, there's no doctor that has ambiguity about being a doctor because it's very clear. I'm a doctor and I've got I'm board certified or I'm part of this medical association and it's clear, right? And people come, they can be different types of doctors. They can come to doctors being a doctor differently. But coach is such an amorphous term now. It means everything. I mean, and so there's not a clear identity really for a coach. It's not as obvious as it is in other professions. And then we have a lot of sort of legacy players in this space, which again, have not, in my personal opinion, have not evolved to keep up with where coaching actually is. And so it's hard for a coach to know, like, where is my loyalty and who gets to decide what I do? And it's not very clear. And so that I think is an external environmental barrier for them and for all of us. And then I think it's trying to kind of move out of a more dominant Western paradigm that I'm to begin to think about. I think coaching was an extraordinary invention 30 years ago or 40 years ago. And it made development available to people in ways we've never had before. And so I'm really grateful for that. And I think the world's a better place for that. And I feel like we're now at a place where it's time for yet another revolution slash evolution. That this was not the end point of coaching's journey. It was just the beginning. And I feel like there's a lot of opportunities now for us to begin to imagine what does coaching want to become now? That, yeah.
What would you say about that? What coaching wants to become now? Yeah.
So one of the things in the final version of the paper was I just created a sort of a little taxonomy for kind of beginning to get some more refined language into the mix, ranging all the way from people that are using coaching to be a better parent or a better partner, all the way up to people that are kind of using coaching as a means and kind of in their job, right? So we had a whole bunch of surgeons in my office in the room when I was doing the thing at the conference, and there's some of them wanting to try to get certified as a coach, and they were just laughing, and they're asking me this after being through a decade of medical school and training and all these other things, and but they coaching for them is part of their doing their job. And so it's a different kind of coaching in a way, it's a different pathway. And then there's people that are professional coaches, probably need a lot more and more rigorous structure and more things there to take that seriously, more than we have now. And then there's a whole bunch of people like myself that were never really a coach. We just use coaching as one of our modalities. And that modality can show up and it then led to integrative development, which is my second body of work, which was to bring coaching into training and consulting. And so that we're doing all of them at the same time. And so I think there's going to be a sort of a separation of, there needs to be some greater distinctions about what does it mean to be a coach? What is coaching? I feel like there's going to be opportunities for us to interface with technology and develop a whole new set of roles for coaching we don't even have yet. I feel like there's the notion of how we bundle coaching is going to change, because we often it just add to the overwhelm of our clients with more stuff to do, and nobody wants more stuff to do these days. We're trying to get rid of it as fast as we can. So it might be, and most, because we're so caught up in our coaching, we don't always fully appreciate what somebody else needs and is capable of at any moment in time. And so I was sharing with the group yesterday about, so like, what if if a client paid for an hour, they could receive 10 minute sessions, or they could bundle and have 3 hours with you, or they could, I feel like, again, that one of the radical propositions in the paper is that that what I want to do, if I were to assess a coach, I'm interested in assessing the coach for development purposes for them to understand what they've done and what they might want to improve. But ultimately, the ultimate measure is what is the client capable of doing after they've left. Now, you don't have full control over that, but that's the orientation, because I want us to be able to design processes that help a person get what they need for the next steps they need to take. That's it. What are they ready, willing, and able to do now? And everything else, is maybe for later, but isn't as significant. And oftentimes we overload things because we want to see results at the end of a session. And it doesn't really work that way in real life. Nobody changes on schedule.
Yeah. So there's a lot in that. So like when it, 'cause the question was like, what does coaching need to become? So I'm hearing, like, in a sense, like more delineated in terms of the different types of coaching. There's the explicit profession of coaching, and then there's like co coaching as a way of being, which maybe is more general. And I see that being, Peter Lindbergh, who I've referred to a few times on the podcast recently, wrote a post about friendships of virtue. How, in a sense, like it seems like there is a movement or a need for like a deeper type of enriching interaction in general in the world, between people that affords more wisdom and virtue and friendship in the world. So that being one of the movement, and I'm hearing you say like, and then how do we have more rigor in how we we develop coaches. And I'm wondering what you think about something like, you said people don't want more stuff to do, and I get that. And what's my question here? So it's really, this is a really nascent question that's forming, but it's like something
Sure.
along the lines of like, what about coaching embracing the agenda of the world, as being a rather than like, this is something I got from Peter Hawkins, where he's like, don't ask what the client wants, ask what the world wants the client
Yeah, exactly.
to bring in. It's that kind of focus on like, as we cease like coaching in a bubble and recognize we're in this world with all these crises and rapid pace of change. And we recognize we've maybe created a hyper individualized sense of self. How can we open the guiding agenda of what coaching is to bring about a better world or help us navigate towards a world of better flourishing? Like, I don't know if there was a question in that, but as you can, but
It
yeah, what do you
sounded
think
good.
about that in terms of, coaching?
So a couple of things. One is, again, one of the limitations of competency models is it tends to decontextualize behavior and assume that a behavior is the optimal in every situation, which is not true. And so we want to bring context back in. And another reason why we want to bring context back in is that a lot of what drives and informs our behavior is our environment, not ourselves, in a way. It's our relationship with our environment and it with us. But coaching doesn't address that. And so a really common scenario, you're coaching a leader about how to, make some things better, do some things differently, be happier, whatever they're after. And then ultimately realize, oh, I can't stand my job anymore. I need to quit. Right. Well, that's one solution. And it's one, it could be a very viable outcome for that person. But part of why I created integrative development was I was in a lot of those dilemmas running these large change programs or leadership programs. And I realized that people were being held back by their own environment. And I thought, there's no point. And this phrase I picked up from someone else about we need to stop sending changed people back into unchanged environments. And so I feel like, and this is where I think AI maybe in time is going to be able to help us some, but it's like looking at, even if you're an individual coach, looking at your client in a system. And what about the system can we bring into the room when we're working such that the client understands kind of how they got to be this way and how they feel about all that? And but also then how do they want to relate to the environment differently, or even support a better environment? And so a lot of people inside companies are under enormous pressure these days on a lot of fronts. And so we can teach them mindfulness and we can teach them organizational skills. We can teach them all kinds of things to cope. But what they're really hungry for, which is what you alluded to earlier, was I want deeper connections. I want to be feel more centered in my own life and not just whipped around. I want to be able to create something that's meaningful for me and make a contribution. And so the higher order desires that people have, we often don't get to as much anymore because people are just so busy coping. And so I don't want us to be expensive band-aids. And sometimes somebody just needs a shoulder to cry on or something to process. But I feel like we have all these people that are now invested a lot in developing themselves as a coach, but they're now stuck in a box called coaching. And I look at it as that's just one box you could play in. And I feel like if we could unlock people's capacity to imagine what else could coaching look like or become based on who you are and what you know and what you care about. And a lot of the places where we face a lot of difficulty are are not going to be resolved by coaching sessions. A, because the vast majority of people can't afford it. And B, it's the coaching hour, which sometimes can be a nice safe harbor, is disconnected from the reality they're facing that brought them to coaching in the first place. So why can't we bring coaching to the field? So coaching ends up being more like a MASH unit, if that makes that TV reference makes any sense, than a nice surgical suite in a really pristine hospital. And we're out kind of just in doing things, trying to bring all these different threads which lead to a client being in the space they're in. And so I see that in some of our students, they're now beginning, like we have a lot of facilitators that come to our program, and they're now experimenting with, can I bring coaching into facilitated moments? When like maybe somebody should have said doesn't show up very maturely, rather than saying, oh my God, there's wrecked the facilitation, or we've got to manage that, just doing a little coaching intervention. How can I help you show up as a fuller sense of yourself so the facilitation can get back on track? And that would, I would see that as a great example of, it's not really coaching, but they're using what they know about coaching and who they are to show up differently in that moment.
Yeah, thanks for taking my kind of not quite well formed question. And like I'm now like ensconced in that sense of that coaching can't just be happening in a bubble, and that needs to be, you know, if we are to make it through these times, there needs to be a wider transformation of this ecosystem of transformation and support. And almost like the verbing of coaching, you know, as you said, like we've made coach a noun, but like if we see it as a verb, then it become like that metaphor of an ecosystem for me affords like a new way of thinking about all the touch points. And you know, there's a quote I wrote down, which I don't know if it's quite appropriate here, but it's like from Zach Stein. It's not from your paper, but he wrote like, what if the goal of society is as encoded in its very legal structures, was not endless accumulation of wealth, but the endless actualization of human potential. And somehow there's a sense of flavor of that in what you're sharing, in that if we actually recodified our structures, then, and including how we hold what coaching is, then that could it could afford human the actualization of human potential. So a couple of like questions that come up for me, like what, like if I was to put you on the spot, then what is your role? Like what role do you play? And I know that you might say, hey, well actually that's the whole point. It's like it's not about being one role, but if I was to, you know, ask you like how would you define yourself?
For myself, in terms of what I do, good luck. I've been trying to for 20 years. It will sound too esoteric, but so mostly I view myself as a steward of the moment. And so I'm aware of what I know, and mostly aware of what I don't know. So I bring who I am and what I've done across all the degrees and life experiences, and then to be able to show up in any moment of time in my life or in my work to see, can we take this precious moment and do something with this? And the example I gave yesterday in class was about an encounter. This one feels like to me the epitome of coaching at its purest, or at its most unleashed. A couple of years ago, I was coming back through San Francisco Airport, and there's poor people that work for the security firms, and it's a tough job. And our particular queue at the conveyor belt was kind of backing up, and so I was kind of just looking, and eventually got through. And there was these two young people. They seemed like they're brand new on the job. They were kind of there, and there was a man, probably about your age, in a wheelchair, and which then was part of the delay because that's not really set up for that. And he was not in a good way. And I had this sort of story I was making up that had come out, flown out for treatments. It's not going well. He had a giant bag on his lap that was nothing but medications that told me he's in serious trouble, you know. And he just seemed really not in a good space. And they're wanting to take out every single little thing in his bag, and they're going on and on. And he's like, I just need to go. And and I'm standing there, and I'm like, you can't really intervene because then you get thrown in the pokey. You can, you can't. It's hard to know, like, what do I do in this moment in time? And so, this idea of being a steward is, I said to myself, what can I do here? Because the line's backing up. This poor man is suffering even more. These two young people feel so bad about themselves because they can see the pain they're causing this guy, this delay. So I just was waiting for my bag to come through, and I just sort of sidled, moved a bit closer to the guy in the wheelchair. And I just looked at the two young people, with as much compassion as I could muster on my face and from my soul. And I said, I see you, and I see the struggle you feel in yourself between your obligation to do a good job and what is actually the right thing to be doing. And I didn't say anything. And I just kind of nodded and looked at them, kind of held them and then they began to slowly kind of look around, and you could see they were accelerating their capacity to look through the bag. And pretty soon they're like just kind of like stuffing things in, and but in a way that allowed them to feel like they've done their job, but they also can get this man on his way, and they kind of put him through, and they both sort of nodded. No one said a word because the bosses were standing right there. And then I just went over and kind of sort of gauged social permission and just put my hand on the man's shoulder that was sitting in the wheelchair. And I just said something like, I'm sorry this is so hard for you. And he never didn't acknowledge me, nor did I need that. But then he kind of gathered his stuff, and because when I was it kind of in a different space, and then wheeled off to his gate. And for me, that's not coaching, but I can't think of anything more beautiful that I've done in years. For me, that was, and I feel like, again, my fundamental value in all this is integrity. Am I integrity with myself? Am I in integrity with my agreements? And am I integrity with the moment in time? The rest, I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. And so I didn't want to invade the man in the wheelchair space. I just lightly put my hand on his shoulder very briefly. I didn't want to invade the TSA process because that would get me in trouble and create a mess for everybody and slow everything down even more. And I just said, well, in this moment, what could I be doing that makes this a better human moment for everybody? For the people in line who are frustrated, for the young officers who are like petrified. And for the man in the wheelchair, he has a few moments of grace in what looks like an otherwise very challenging day. That for me is the essence of what coaching should be like.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And it's a beautiful window into what moves you in your heart of hearts. And it's a view of coaching I resonate with very much. And it makes me want to ask the question of, like, how would you invite others into their own version of that, that authentic or core kind of value? Or
So several things. I think one, doing an inventory of one's life, like who am I? How did I get here? What do I, a lot of coaches ingest a lot of stuff. And so I encourage our coaches to Marie Kondo their lives and their coaching practice. What did you think was so exciting, but you never use? So let the book go, give it to a friend, right? So part of it's simplifying and getting to know yourself and what you're bringing. Part of it is recognizing your own limitations and where you need to grow yourself to be able to hold the space for others. I realized that, many years later, many decades later, that I grew up in a family of five individuals, that we did nice things together, but there was not Empathy was not part of the vocabulary or expression in our home. I think people basically cared for each other, but no one ever said anything about that. And I realized I was, even though I've always been a fairly kind person, I didn't really, it took me a long time to learn how to be more expressive in my empathy because I didn't have that growing up. And so I think it's just somebody, because a question I often get asked is, well, how do I become more mature? I said, well, I can't teach you that. You can't teach maturity in a way. You just create opportunities for people to mature or not. And so I said, the fastest way to mature is to process suffering. And the more you can process suffering, that will be your most stellar path to mature. And the people who don't process suffering well tend to be less mature because they don't want to go to those spaces. But yeah, and so for me, I just feel like, focusing less on getting better as a coach and what do I need to do on myself to be a better human being? And facing your own shadow, doing your own unconscious work, doing family constellation work, doing whatever it takes for you to get a more robust and both candid and compassionate view of yourself. That for me will serve you infinitely better than just doing more coaching.
Yeah.
And so in that, sorry, Jill, to interrupt, but
Yeah, go ahead.
in that, one of the things that sort of came to me in the book was in the paper was grounding a narrative coaching in a rites of passage frame. So I think a lot of this is collectively creating more ritual, more creating apprenticeships, creating rites of passage that are not about certification levels. There's nothing to do with certification levels much, but there's not a social construct or a social apparatus in coaching easily to gauge your one's maturity. It's all about I have 12 certifications or I've reached this level of whatever and but those again are mostly based on competency, not on maturity. And so there's a whole bunch of things we don't ask coaches in terms of gauging their progress, which would be really helpful for them and for us to understand how to support them. Because in the reality that we most of what we have in coaching is trying to scale novices, which is great for business, but it doesn't really. We need to interview people that are actually masterful at the craft, regardless of whether they're members of anything or what they call themselves, or and because in the fifth of the maturities in my model is called credibility. So credibility has two halves. Well, they all do, but this one particularly. So it's credibility of does what you do work? Are you credible that you're a good coach, right? But it also is inner credibility. Like, do you understand what just happened? Can you provide not necessarily from a theoretical perspective, but do you understand the dynamics of that experience or that change process enough where you have a credible understanding and grasp of this? And people that achieve true mastery, which is not very common, are so intimately involved with all the pieces of the puzzle that they can mix and match them. They can notice those subtleties in them. And the biggest observation I get about this in watching coaches is not that they don't know what to do, it's just that they don't see most of what's happening.
Yeah, I've, yeah, and paradoxically though, one of the biggest traps coaches have is they try to add more and more theoretical understanding of somebody through methods and maps, and don't do what you've been talking about, which is like become master connoisseurs of the present moment. So they're trapped in like trying like almost like a kind of abstracted experience of being with the client, which is, you know, I think a part of a phase of on the journey towards mastery. What you said, you know, those maps and models become just so habituated that you don't need to kind of use your kind of present moment awareness to sort through them, they just come to the foreground. But yeah, so not to contradict you, but it's
Yeah.
like, but there's something about like wisdom here for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's wisdom's a better word than like the wise people. They just kind of can locate, they can make sense of where you're at.
Yeah, and the theories and things sit in the background, and there's so I think we're saying much the same thing, but there's an apocryphal story about a very famous African American jazz musician, and they were just really curious about his upbringing and his background, and they asked him if he had any musical training. He said, "Yeah, I studied music for quite a while, but then it started getting in the way of my playing, so I stopped." And yeah, and so I was wise enough to realize this will only take me so far. And a lot of times coaches feel like I have to get all this stuff and keep getting all this stuff, but most of it you're never going to use. Like, go to your life. Like, average, I tell my coach sometimes if I'm feeling a bit, whatever, go to the library at your house and where you have your books at your house. Look on the shelves. Which ones? When was the last time you read most of these? Which one of these actually do you use in your life or your practice? And it doesn't mean you have to get rid of them, but I just like feeling like you, because maturity is the foundation for all of mastery. So if you're trying to just like add on more mastery stuff, but your foundation's down here, you've got a, a 10 meter by 10 meter foundation, and you're trying to build a mansion, it's not going to work. So you only can learn things as your maturity rises, and you can only actually learn things if you've reached a certain level, because otherwise you're just piling more stuff onto a platform that can't hold it. And so there's plenty more to keep learning. There's plenty more to study, but is not as useful for you if you waited to the point where your maturity to appreciate what it actually is. I've been having this long-standing conversation with a dear friend my age, and we talked about we've read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance like four or five times in our life, usually once a decade as a ritual. But every time the book's different because we're now like, oh, that's what he meant, because we now have lived it, right? And in the beginning, it's just yeah. So I feel like there needs to be a balance of maturity and mastery, and then the two have to go hand in hand at sort of an unfolding kind of spiraling way, not in a linear straight line.
I'm really glad you mentioned rites of passage and apprenticeship before, because they're very evocative to me as ideas, but metaphors or journeys. And it's interesting because I was about to ask a question or share something, and then you kind
Okay.
of followed on and shared that, and I was like, oh, that's amazing, because I was going to talk about, for me, I use this term, I don't know how comfortable you're with, but like, it's the path of ensoulment. So, I've three paths in my own life that have been useful, like individuation, awakening, and ensoulment. And so this path of at a certain point, doing enough integration that like the parts of me, the socialized parts of me that were running me, have integrated, and there's that kind of bursting forth of my kind of ensouled self, or my kind of authentic self, which has a unique expression. And but that's a scary thing to do, because it means revealing oneself, and and for me, that's been a very sacred process of aligning with what's calling me in this life, and coaching as an act of service. And inside of that, what is it that lights me up as a coach? What are those books, the ones that I did read and apply? And how come I, and what are the bits of my coaching that I seem to keep using and coming back to? And so actually going on a journey of like removing the consumption of more and more information to actually tap into, create space for that calling to emerge more clearly, has really served me in on my journey towards coaching mastery, which I
Yeah, that's
so
great.
and I find that a lot of coaches, they want to pay for more tools. Like they want trainings with more tools. They're less interested when you say the thing that will make the biggest difference is not that, is your maturity, what you're saying. They're less interested. That's maybe a bit of a generalization.
But if you think about classic rites of passages, like rituals that are involved in the passage from boy to manhood or girl to womanhood, one of the quintessential elements near the very beginning is cutting them off. You can't go back there. You're not a boy anymore. You're a man, right? As recognized by us, or you're a woman. And to celebrate that, but it can be quite harsh because we want to cling to who we were and what we knew. Well, we don't have that in coaching. And so what happens is, because of the prevalence of competency models, we just look at levels of movement through coaching as more advanced competencies. Well, no. I mean, so like one of the like things like creating opportunities for people to demonstrate their coaching, practice their coaching, get feedback on their coaching, but which includes you can't use what you learned in the beginning. That's a boy's or a girl's view of coaching, right? You don't get to have an agenda. You can't have any goals, right? And have some more like even fun with this, like in practice. Have a person present an issue. Now go give me 12 different first questions. And stretch, so again, it has to do with the maturity. Can I rise above my attachment to my form? And, you know, it's one of the gifts and or curses, depending on how you look at it, aging. I've gained a much deeper appreciation. I'm moving into a phase of my life I've obviously never been in. I've now outlived my father, so I don't even have a role model about how to be an older man. And you start to realize that so much of this is not about learning just what's coming or what's true and present now, but what's not going to be useful for me if I cling to it from a past part of my life. And and we don't have a lot of easy structures because we're in a consumerist kind of culture where we just more and more and more. And so in a world where that's becoming a problem, I think there's an invitation for us to challenge us all as coaches. And it's almost like having a workshop where the whole sole intent of the workshop is to get rid of as much as possible. Yeah. And you can think like symbolically, bring all the library books or the books you have that you're not going to use anymore. And we'll just do trades, or we'll donate them or whatever. And kind of going through your file folders and your filing cabinets and your I find that I do that all the time. I just find it so liberating. Yeah. And I get to the point now where I don't need anything anymore that way. And I recognize every people are going to be at different stages of their career, but it's like we gather, and by midlife, go, oh crap, I don't really need all that. And then we go and get back down and get to the end of your life. And there's a great scene at the end of a movie called Fried Green Tomatoes, where this older woman is at this crossroads, literally at the streets. She's got a little like jewelry box or something. And everything that she has left in the world is in that box. I thought, excellent.
Yeah.
Because then we're just left with two humans having a conversation.
Yeah. I when I lived alone, my apartment became sparser and sparser until it came to a point where there was like, oh my, you know, it's not the case now. I was watching Shogun. It's a great series. And they sleep in these amazing rooms with like nothing in it, basically, like apart from the, you know, the beautiful Japanese architecture. And then there's just like this little futon, you know, in the middle of the room. And I'm like, that looks like the most amazing place to sleep. It's so like, in Dutch you say gezellig, like it's so cozy. It's like decluttered, you know, like energetically pure space. I've got one final question for you.
Sure.
Who are the masterful coaches out there that you, because you said earlier, like there's a lot of legacy coaches or trainers who haven't evolved to where coaching is. I won't put you on the spot and ask you who you think those are.
I'm not saying, I refuse.
That's maybe one for over a beer or a
Yeah,
coffee.
there we go.
But who are the masterful coaches out there that you know?
Well, so a couple of things. So one is I don't know because we don't get to watch each other. I know some amazing human beings in the coaching space. So there's a woman, Donna Carlin in Canada. We've done some things together and she's a hoot. An extraordinarily successful coach and a really deep person. She like me, has been through some things of recent years, and I just saw her in Boston. And but we don't witness each other. We don't actually get to the core of what we're actually doing. And so what most coaches know are the celebrities, which have a varying range of, in my view, a varying range of capability as coaches. Because coaching is designed, again, like in our institutional sense, to scale novices to get them better. We don't actually learn from true masters. And so there probably are some extraordinary coaches out there that you and I don't even know, because they don't publicize themselves so much. Whatever reason. And I feel like so we're at a phase in coaching where I think we need to transform and accelerate our capacity to develop ourselves to keep up with the world we've created. And that means we've got to find more ways of being in different kinds of conversations, like less conferences, less programs, and more dialogue with each other, and more learning from each other, challenging each other. I had a woman the other day really challenged me on something I said in class. And I still stand by what I said, but she raised some really interesting points I had never thought of. It didn't really change my mind, but I thought, oh, I could see how this might sound to her. And so I thought, wow. And I applauded her. I said, thank you for speaking up. I said, I learned a lot from listening to you. And we don't have that. We don't have that way of learning, and we don't have that way of finding out who the true masters are, as opposed to the ones that are perceived as gurus or whatever. The last thing I'll say, Joel, when I was doing my set, one of my two sessions at the conference in Boston, there was a man who got up when we were sort of bringing the thing to a close. He said, I just want to acknowledge you for how you showed up in this hour, so different than everybody else at this conference. And so for me, that was the highest compliment he could pay me. Yeah.
Totally. I think of some of the people who've coached me, and I'm like, yeah, I'd put them in the mastery bucket, but it does make me reflect on like what's possible, because I agree with you. I'm 100% sure it's like an iceberg or something that the true master, there's so many masterful coaches out there. I'd love to hear from them, to be honest, if you're listening to this. Honestly, because I totally get it. There's a mixed bag with the celebrity coaches. Some of them, and even in some of them, on an individual basis, it's like how they present themselves and how I've met them privately being coached is a big difference. And I'm like, wow, how come? Wow, you're actually a really great coach, but like the public personas doesn't seem as that way, so anyway, yeah, fascinating. Thank you so much, David. I know there's a lot about your paper that we haven't referred to, but
Fine.
I really appreciate our conversation, and I think there's a lot of really powerful distinctions and invitations you've made in our conversation. So
Thanks.
yeah, thanks again. Do you want to let people know about your work and stuff? I would wait if you want to direct people towards you.
So it's just themomentinstitute.com, and you can find the five maturities paper there. We're starting a bunch of new initiatives in the fall to run the five maturities and a whole different kind of learning community. So we're stopping teaching programs. This is our last year to teach programs, and we're creating something completely different. So if you'd like to be part of all that, they can just find me on our website. Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.